The trouble with the world today, it seems to me, is coffee in a cardboard cup. The trouble with the affluent society is coffee in a cardboard cup.
Well, that coffee in a cardboard cup now costs about $4 a shot, a far cry from the quarter for a cup of joe that we used to pay at the local diner. And that cup of joe is now not good enough. Most of us need a grande latte or something along those lines. And for that, you can thank or blame Starbucks. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, November the 8th. And we will talk about the rise of the Starbucks Corporation and how it has changed life, as many of us know it. And we'll wonder if you love Starbucks or view the coffee giant as some sort of villain. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us Taylor Clark, a former staff writer for the Portland, Oregon Alternative Weekly, and the author of the new book, Starbucked, a double tall tale of caffeine, commerce, and culture. He is currently a freelance writer in Oregon, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, your hometown is Ashland, Oregon?
Yeah. Ashland, Oregon is a little sort of artsy theater town on the border, the southern border between Oregon and California.
Yeah, and the infiltration of Starbucks to Ashland is one of the reasons that you looked into this subject?
Mm-hmm. I would say that the first thing that got me interested in Starbucks was when Starbucks moved into my hometown when I was finishing up high school. I remember that everyone there swore that they would never go to Starbucks. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember, you know, my girlfriend handing out stickers and saying she'd never go there, and pretty soon after it opened, you know, not only were we going there, me and my girlfriend,
everybody
was going there. So I started to think that there was something kind of, you know, interesting and sort of seductive about this company and the coffee house movement, and that's kind of what got me first interested in it.
Yeah, there's actually a movement and stickers that say friends don't let friends go to Starbucks.
I think at a certain point with any chain that grows as fast as Starbucks has, which, you know, is a pretty short list, but, you know, there's always a subset of people who aren't too happy to see the chain come in for a number of reasons, and Starbucks is one of the top chains in that regard.
Well, yeah, that a similar thing happened in Madison when, I don't remember how many years ago it was, that the first Starbucks came to State Street in Madison, and there was a movement. We don't want this big chain on our quaint little street.
Right. I do. I actually remember reading, when I was researching the book, I remember reading a news report about Starbucks opening, I think, near the university in Madison, and people coming in on the opening day, students who were protesting and, you know, kind of staging a sit-in or something.
Yeah, and in fact, some of the arguments that those protesters brought up, you talk about in your book, like the thought that this was going to shut down all the other wonderful little coffee houses on State Street or in any community, the mom-and-pop coffee shop will go out of business because of Starbucks. Is that true?
It's actually not. I mean, it's one of the surprising facts of the rise of the coffeehouse movement and of Starbucks that, for some reason, I mean, Starbucks will place a store right next to a mom and pop a lot of the time, and people will expect that the mom and pop will go out of business, but suddenly they'll find that their sales are up and that tons more people in the area are now paying attention to coffee, because Starbucks kind of, whenever they come into a new city or a new town, they sort of raise the profile of coffee in that area, and they do a lot of marketing, and they snare a lot of customers, and pretty soon those overflow customers are going elsewhere. And so, you know, if you look at, there's kind of a myth that independent coffee houses have been dying off, and if you look at it, even in the last 5 years, the number of independent coffee houses in the country has gone up 40%.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you would think, I think there was an idea years ago that there were only so many coffee houses that a city could handle.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that when you think about it, you know, everyone drinks coffee. So pretty much everyone is a potential customer in any given city. It's not like, you know, nobody's going to be eating hamburgers every day, God willing. So, but, you know, coffee is one of those things that a lot of people buy, and it turns out they're willing to pay a lot of money for it. And so there's a lot of the pie to go around.
Yeah. Starbucks won't just open up one store, though, in a community. Usually they'll open up many and right across the street from each other.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's you know, for the same reason that I was just talking about. You know, people are kind of mystified by the fact that there can be a Starbucks across the street from a Starbucks, but it turns out that, you know, a lot of people drink coffee. And if you have a line out the door at one store, then to Starbucks it makes sense to open one as close by as possible so that, you know, people don't have to go outside their daily routines. You know, if the line's too long at one store, you just go to the one next door.
Yeah, talk about how that idea started for Starbucks.
Well, the first Starbucks across the street from the Starbucks happened in Vancouver, British Columbia, back in the early 90s, when it was actually sort of... It was sort of serendipitous because Howard Schultz, who's the chairman of Starbucks, his top store, this was back when Starbucks only had about 80 stores, his top store was on this corner in a busy area of Vancouver, and the building was going to be demolished in a few years. The landlord wanted to improve it. And so they were wondering what to do without their top store. They weren't making a ton of money at that point. And so Schultz had this kind of harebrained scheme that he would put another coffee house across the street because the other one was so busy,
mm-hmm.
and people were being turned away at the door all the time. And so he just thought, you know, at the worst thing that could happen is that there will be a lot of news stories about us and the coffee company that's crazy enough to put two coffee houses across the street from each other. And it turned out that, to everyone's surprise and maybe his, not only did both stores succeed when they were about 20 feet away from each other, pretty soon they were the number one and number two performing stores in the chain, so which is staggering mm-hmm. when you think about it.
Yeah, it is. And didn't I read that they were slightly different in their atmosphere?
Yeah.
They thought they had different customers.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. they were trying, you know, at the mm-hmm. time they were trying to make it so that, you know, people wouldn't think that they were just exact clones of each other. And there was an idea that maybe they could get different clientele for each store, you know, to kind of differentiate the two so they weren't exactly the same.
Yeah, and Starbucks will often locate very strategically next to places like dry cleaners and video stores because of, well, you tell us why.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting little trick. I don't know how much in reality
mm-hmm.
it works, but, you know, it just kind of shows Starbucks' real estate acumen because somebody there at some point figured out that, you know, every time you go to a video store, or a dry cleaner, you go there once to drop something off and one to pick something up. So every time you want to go there, you're going to have to go twice, which gives you two chances to pick up a latte if a Starbucks is right next door.
Yeah, and right there in Portland, Oregon, two of Starbucks stores are 12 feet apart.
Yeah, about. If you know, it's kind of, people get used to seeing Starbucks next to Starbucks, but still, like, you know, sometimes, you know, it's a little close for comfort or something. You know, you if you stand on the second floor of the mall in downtown Portland called Pioneer Place Mall, you can see that there's a Starbucks on the first floor and then there's another one directly above it on the third floor. So, you know, theoretically, if you were tall enough, you could, like, almost reach up and connect the two Starbucks.
Yeah. And is this still going on as strong as ever, the opening of Starbucks coffee houses all over the country and all over the world, for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, their major target right now is international. Yeah, I mean, they are, right now, they are opening about six stores a day, and they're coming up on 15,000 stores right now, but they want to get up past 40,000 eventually.
Yeah. You know, now I'm going to state my personal bias, which I normally don't do as a, you know, a talk show host. I try
sure.
to keep my opinions out of it.
Right.
I drink Starbucks coffee from time and again, but
uh-huh.
I don't like the taste of it as much as I like the taste of other coffees. It tastes burnt or bitter to me. It's got like a burnt taste to it. But still, I'll still go, and these stores are still packed. And you mentioned this in your book, is that it's not the taste of the coffee so much as the Starbucks experience.
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that they figured out, kind of to everyone at the company's chagrin. They figured out that you know, early on, Starbucks was obsessed with coffee quality, you know, back when they were a very small chain. And they didn't want to adulterate the coffee experience at all. It was a big deal for them even to introduce syrups. And there was, you know, they would have shouting matches over whether or not they'd offer low-fat milk. And so, you know, they were purists at the beginning. And then, you know, when they were looking to expand and they were doing market research, they found that people didn't really, when they talked about coffee and what they wanted in a coffee house experience, they didn't talk about like the flavor and the, you know, the profiles of the beans and the roast. They talked about a certain environment and a feeling that they wanted to have. You know, they wanted to feel warm. They wanted to feel, you know, sort of like, you know, almost being in the womb. You know, that's why the Starbucks stores had the, you know, velour couches and the, you know, it's a very comfortable environment. And you know, that was one of the kind of innovations that made Starbucks succeed, is that they focused more on the lifestyle than on, you know, they focused on their product, but they poured a lot of attention into the lifestyle and into the psychology of their customers.
We're talking about Starbucks and how the coffee giant has influenced our culture. Talking with the author of the new book, Starbucked, A Double Tall Tale of Caffeine, Commerce, and Culture. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question about how Starbucks came to be, or if you have an opinion on the good or the bad of Starbucks. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
We are talking about coffee this hour, and in particular, Starbucks coffee. Talking about the rise of the corporate coffee giant and how it's changed our caffeine habits and caffeine prices. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Taylor Clark, a former staff writer at the Portland, Oregon Alternative Weekly, currently a freelance writer, and the author of Starbucked, A Double Tall Tale of Caffeine, Commerce, and Culture. And our lines are filled up with the callers at the moment, but you can join in, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Sheila in Nina is with us now. Hi, Sheila.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. What would you like to say?
I am just wondering, this sounds negative, but I don't really mean it to be, but I'm wondering if with the volume of buying that Starbucks does of coffee beans, if they're like the Walmart of the coffee houses and that they control the coffee market?
Yeah, you know, you might think so, given how ubiquitous Starbucks seems. But really, Starbucks only buys about 2 or 3% of the world's coffee. So, you know, it's one of those cases where it seems like Starbucks is everywhere, but, you know, people drink a lot of coffee at home. There are a lot of independent coffee houses and, you know, so Starbucks doesn't shape the market in that way. They're more like the, you know, they're as the industry leader, they're people pay attention to what they do, and they can kind of set the tone. But they don't control it in the same way that Walmart does.
Yeah, Starbucks needed to be nudged or forced into getting fair trade coffee.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, I think with something like fair trade coffee, especially a retailer as smart as Starbucks that it, you know, knows marketing, knows that if they offer fair trade coffee, then you know they might kind of run the risk of saying the rest of their coffee is evil.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think it's
like fair
a little
or evil coffee.
Yeah, it would basically mean Starbucks, in a sense, admitting that the rest of their coffee was not fair. Mm-hmm. So it took a while, but they sort of came around. There are people in the sort of fair trade coffee industry who are angry at the fair trade organization for sort of taking Starbucks in when Starbucks wasn't fully committed to the cause. But, you know, to a lot of farmers, obviously, they don't care about the hair splitting, and they're just happy that more fair trade coffee is being sold.
Yeah. The rise of Starbucks, and for that matter, our entire culture, the caffeine crazy culture, this has been good for the coffee, you know, for the coffee growers, hasn't it?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's certainly kind of split the market apart in a way. The situation for coffee growers is way too complicated to go into in brief. But, you know, the fact is that coffee growers have been struggling for hundreds of years because their crop is really finicky and really reliant on the weather. And so a frost somewhere that kills a lot of the crop will send the price skyrocketing. And then, you know, if they have a good crop year and there's a glut, the prices will be down. And that's been the main determinant of coffee growers' fortunes for a while. There's no market control to keep coffee off the market anymore. There used to be during the Cold War. There was an organization that kept coffee off the market, so they had a stabilized price. But I think it's fair to say that in general, the specialty coffee movement, the coffee house movement, has been good for farmers because there's just greater demand for a high quality product, and so the ones who can grow good beans can get a good price.
Tell me if you can explain, you know, I'm sitting here right now with my cup of coffee roasted by a local, you know, premium coffee house. It wasn't Starbucks, but I remember the day when I used to drink Taster's Choice Instant Coffee. And now I can't imagine doing that. You know, at the time, I couldn't imagine grinding my own beans or paying $4 for a latte. How did this happen?
Yeah, well, that, you know, for you know, almost for the reason that you're hinting at. I mean, it was terrible coffee, right? So, you know, there was, I think, a time when you know, back in sort of the 50s and 60s, when processed foods were really taking off, and at the time they really seemed like the wave of the future. You know, Tang seemed like a great choice, and flavor crystals seemed new and innovative or something. But I think at a certain point, people realized that they'd been having bad food for a while, and there was nothing sort of, you know, we've kind of gotten used to the rise of companies like Whole Foods and stuff that offer really high-quality stuff. And, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that just really was not the case. And so, you know, the kind of quality coffee that you can get at a coffee house like Starbucks was a revelation to people, especially when Starbucks, in the early days, when it was more quality focused, it was a small chain, and it was really known for the quality of its coffee. And then, you know, Starbucks kind of popularized the trend. You know, they weren't the only people doing coffee, but certainly their marketing abilities and their real estate abilities really helped make people willing to pay that much for coffee.
Yeah, it's changed, like the Folgers in the Maxwell House and all that. Those other non-premium coffees too at the grocery store. Now they're coming out with their, you know, whatever their gourmet blends.
Yeah, well, and it took them quite a while to catch on. Yeah,
Jim in Phillips is with us now. Hi, Jim.
Hello. You're talking about the Starbucks experience. What about airports? What's the experience there? All they have is a counter, and they charge you the same.
It's just an expensive
cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's you know, the airports are actually not only the airports, but the Starbucks stores that you see in like Barnes and Noble. Those aren't actually operated by the company; they're licensed stores. So Starbucks rents out their brand to, you know, the airport kiosk or whatever, and those employees aren't even Starbucks employees. You can't use your Starbucks card there. A lot of people say that the quality of the coffee and the quality of the experience isn't as good there, but I mean, the fact is, when you're in an airport and you're tired as anything, I don't think too many people are going to complain, you know, about the quality of the Starbucks experience there. They're just happy to get some coffee.
Yeah, don't you admit to you don't drink Starbucks all the time, but if you're in an airport, you will.
Yeah, I don't drink. I basically would only drink Starbucks in an emergency circumstance, and that's mainly because, you know, I live in Portland, and we, you know, here in Portland, we have just sort of an embarrassment of good coffee houses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I've had my, you know, I try to stay objective in the book, but, you know, at the end of the day, kind of the ubiquity of Starbucks kind of bugs me. But aside from that, you know, it's just, you know, you can get better coffee for cheaper in Portland, which isn't necessarily the case in a lot of cities.
Yeah. So that's, it's not just because it's, that you can get equal or better coffee at a cheaper price. You do kind of side with those who say Starbucks is, what was the term you used? It hurts diversity in local towns.
Homogenizing, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a matter of opinion. I mean, I certainly try to come down, you know, as fairly as I can in my book. But, you know, it comes down to a matter of opinion. When you're walking down the street, say, in Beijing, and you see a Starbucks, you know, different people are going to react different ways to that. Some people will be really happy to see it. But other people, and, you know, I'll confess that I'm one of them, are none too pleased, you know, to see kind of a sign of American sort of, you know, globalization and sort of this kind of conforming brand, you know, in all these different places where that had their own kind of cultural heritage before. I mean, you know, there's the idea that, you know, the kind of the spread of brands is leveling off culture in the world. And it's hard, you know, when you see a Starbucks in Beijing or in Tokyo or something, it's hard not to think that something is being lost.
Yeah. Our next caller is Mike in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. About 3 years ago in Business Week magazine, there was a feature on Starbucks, and one of the things it claimed as part of their success was that they had a very enlightened policy with their workers. They would offer their workers, even though they were part-time workers, full benefits, including health benefits, which made their workers very loyal and unwilling to quit and go anywhere else, and reduced turnover to a minimum. I wonder if that's still a policy, or if you know about it.
Yeah, it is, and you know that's one of the things about Starbucks that, you know, even really cynical people can't find much fault in, because nobody was forcing Starbucks and Howard Schultz, the chairman, to offer healthcare to people working 20 hours a week. I mean, it was kind of unheard of, and they have really stuck to that, and Schultz has promised that it's never going to go away. And now they pay more for health insurance for their employees than they do for coffee beans.
Hmm.
And Schultz has really been an advocate. You know, his main issue has probably been universal health care. And so, you know, it's impossible to fault him on that. A lot of people at the company really appreciate that. There are plenty of people who work at Starbucks just for the benefits. And so, you know, that's why turnover at Starbucks has been way, way lower than at comparable chains.
And apparently it's not easy to get a job there. I read about the application process. It's pretty extensive.
Yeah, you know, they have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of resumes on file. Yeah, but, you know, I actually don't know how many. You know, you go to some Starbucks sometimes, and you get the impression that it's not that hard to get a job there nowadays.
Yeah.
So many of them. But, you know, for a long time they were very selective, yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's another anecdote. Going to the other local coffee shops, my husband will mention this, is that it takes a really long time to get that latte, whereas at Starbucks, it's zippity-doo-dah, and you have it in a matter of moments. Do they have some sort of they do have a system that to make it quicker, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, Starbucks calls the coffee game a game of seconds. So, you know, every little step in the coffee making process has been streamlined and even automated. I mean, if you you go into most Starbucks now, and they've been making the conversion from the old hand espresso machines, or not hand, but, you know, where the barista would mm-hmm. pull the shot, you know, by hand and time it, and there was sort of a level of craftsmanship involved. And now all those espresso machines are automated, which means that you just press a button and the machine pulls, you know, kind of the consistent same shot every time. And, you know, that's got that trims the process down considerably. I mean, the milk steaming ones on those too have thermometers in them, and they're programmed to stop when the milk reaches a certain temperature. So there's really no wasted time at all.
Mike in Oshkosh is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Just an interesting observation. I moved here from New England, and it was my observation after first moving to Wisconsin that, as Bob Bucher would state it kind of in a kind way, he says we're so cheap here that essentially people would stand in line for hours to get free grommets. So when you think about the difficulty of actually establishing a franchise in Wisconsin, I mean, Dunkin' Donuts couldn't even make it. They close every time they try to open one. It's amazing to me that Starbucks was able to get a foothold in Wisconsin, because we really are very frugal people here.
Right. Yeah, you know, if for nothing else, one of the impressive things about Starbucks is that it just has not really failed in almost any market. I mean, the only international market that they've gone into and had to really pull out of is Israel, and that was kind of for you know, reasons of security. I mean, there are countries that they've gone into, like China, that had no coffee drinking culture whatsoever before Starbucks came in. You know, they would do, you know, studies and see that people drank less than a cup of coffee a year on average. You know, people just didn't drink it. And they go into China, and all of a sudden they're a huge hit, you know, because of kind of the lifestyle, and people want to be seen with the brand. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into it. It's not just a cup of coffee.
Talk about the very first time in the very first Starbucks store that someone said, give me, you know, whatever the price was for that cup of coffee.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, we're used to spending a quarter on a cup of coffee, and then day Starbucks said, you know, hey, that'll be a few bucks.
I see what you mean. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, originally it wasn't a few bucks. Mm-hmm. I mean, the price increase was really gradual. You know, back in the day when the coffee, when gourmet coffee was just starting with a guy named Alfred Peet, mostly, out in Berkeley. Some people might know the Pete's chain. I don't know if it's out in Wisconsin
at all.
Mm-hmm.
We have one place, the Sundance Theater, has opened up in Madison, and they serve Pete's coffee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Alfred Peet was kind of the guy who inspired many of the people who ended up going on to build bigger coffee chains, because he was one of the first in the country to actually offer fresh roasted, decent coffee. And he was a real taskmaster. And, you know, I thought he actually died recently, sadly. Mm-hmm. But, I got a chance to talk to him, and he's a very smart, uncompromising guy, and he was telling me, you know, in the early days, he was really not charging anything more than what they would have paid in the supermarket. It was actually very cheap, mainly because, you know, coffee is only so expensive now because people will pay for it, you know, but on average, coffee companies pay, you know, in the low $1 range for a pound of raw coffee,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all they do is ship it back and, you know, put it in the oven for 10 minutes and then put it in packages, and then they sell it for $12. So, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
that's just what people, you know, and you know, to be fair, it's still cheaper to drink a cup of good coffee than it is to have a Coke, you know? So you get a really good cup, and it's not actually that expensive.
Right, but eventually with the various espressos and double shots and flavorings and everything else, it's easy to spend whatever, at least $4 for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I mean, the things that really cost the money are really only marginally coffee drinks when you think about it. I mean, the bulk of what you're drinking is milk, and then people will get things like vanilla syrup or raspberry syrup, God forbid, and, you know, those things kind of mask the coffee flavor, so, you know.
Yeah, and what's a Frappuccino anyway?
It's basically a milkshake that people will pay $5 for.
Yeah, and you know, this is a big hit with young people, too. My 14-year-old niece goes to Starbucks to get those kind of, you know, frothy drinks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, there's an idea that, you know, and that the stuff like the Frappuccino is kind of like a gateway drug, right? I mean, you know, because coffee... Mm-hmm. You know, it's like your first sip of coffee is like your first sip of beer. It tastes terrible.
Right.
And, you know, it's really an acquired taste. And something like a Frappuccino is something that is sweet, and you barely taste coffee. And, you know, anyone likes it because everyone likes sweet things. And so that was kind of when Starbucks introduced the Frappuccino, that was kind of what pushed them over the edge into the mainstream, because suddenly it was accessible to people who weren't hardcore coffee drinkers. And it was accessible to people like teenagers. And pretty soon they go from the Frappuccino down to, like, the vanilla latte, you know. And soon, you know, they're coming in every day.
Yeah. And let's take another caller. Alan Schooner, or is it Spooner, Al?
It's Alan Spooner.
Hi, thanks. Al.
Mm-hmm. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
Good. I was wondering why Starbucks chose names for the sizes of their drinks. That small, medium, and large doesn't work there. You got to ask for a tall or a grande.
Yeah, the good question.
Right, yeah, yeah. You know, it actually started back in the early days. They came up with these names kind of off the cuff, and the original sizes were called short, tall, and grande. And the short was smaller than the tall is now. I think it was 8 ounces. And they had those three, so that makes sense, right? I mean, short being small, you know, it's kind of creative. But at a certain point, they introduced a bigger drink because there's much more profit in the larger sizes. You know, it's only, you know, you put 4 ounces more of coffee in there and you charge another, you know, 25 cents for it. It's almost pure profit for you. And so they came up with the 20-ounce size, which is venti. And, you know, venti is 20 in Italian. And they kicked, at that point in time, they kicked the short size off the menu.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was, you know, before Starbucks really cracked into the mainstream. And so people sort of saw it as, like, shifty or, like, almost Orwellian that they were being told that the smallest size was tall. But there's actually an explanation for it.
There are people I know today that refuse to say that. They'll just say, I'll have a small, medium, or large.
Right. It's like a matter of personal integrity. Yeah.
We are talking with Taylor Clark, former staff writer for the Portland, Oregon Alternative Weekly and currently a freelancer in Portland. He is author of the brand new book, Starbucked, a double tall tale of caffeine, commerce, and culture, talking about how Starbucks, the coffee giant, has changed life as many of us know it. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your questions and comments about Starbucks. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, talking about presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani getting a boost from the Christian right yesterday with an endorsement by televangelist Pat Robertson. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about Starbucks, the coffee company, the corporation. Our guest, Taylor Clark, author of the book, Starbucked, a double tall tale of caffeine, commerce, and culture. And our next caller is Jane in Green Bay. Hi, Jane, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think in Wisconsin, coffee houses in general fill a tremendous unmet need as a place for adults to socialize that doesn't necessarily cost you $20 for a meal and doesn't involve drinking. Let's face it, Wisconsin's primary place of socialization for the last 100 years has been the neighborhood tavern, and that creates major problems in this climate.
Yeah, that's you raise a very good point because, you know, I don't think in a vacuum $4 coffee would have been a very successful idea for a business. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certainly the coffee side of it, but there's also the social side of it and the reason that people go and they'll stay there for 3 hours. And what you're talking about is true. I mean, as of 20 years ago or so, the only place where people could go to hang out were places like bars, which are smoky and, you know, people are drunk and you can't really sit and read or relax, you know. And so there's a real need in the country. That, you know, it was actually, you know, that was being served in other countries, like in Europe, you know, coffee houses have been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they served a vital social function. People would go there to, you know, to have a sort of sense of connection with their community. And, you know, in America with the suburbs and people telecommuting and working like crazy, people didn't have that. And, you know, so that is why a movement like the coffeehouse movement really succeeded, is because there was a real need for it.
Thank you, Jane. Ellie or Elle in Waukesha?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, first, my favorite Starbucks-related anything was the cover of The Onion many years ago. Along the side there, it had one of the little headlines that said, Starbucks opens Starbucks in bathroom of Starbucks. And I just thought that just cracked me up. But I'm one of the people who keeps going to Starbucks. I don't go as much as I used to. I spread it all over the place more now because I don't think the coffee's as good as it was when I first started going years and years ago. But because of Howard's involvement in the in trying to get universal health care, and his phenomenal amount of work with other CEOs and his constant push on that. I feel it's an obligation to make sure I support them to some degree, and so I make sure at least once a week that my coffee buying is at Starbucks, and every once in a while I'll go ahead and break down and buy a pound of Sumatra or something, even though I don't think theirs is as good as it used to be. but there are so few high-profile people out there who know how to talk to other CEOs who are trying to do a damn thing about it that that I admire him, and I just feel it's one of my patriotic duties to support Starbucks.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's no doubt that Howard Schultz is a very impressive guy. I mean, he's incredibly charismatic. He's an incredibly effective speaker. He inspires his employees to, you know, to do their best when, you know, a cynical person might say that they're just, you know, pressing buttons and handing people cups of coffee. So he's a very effective guy, you know. In terms of feeling like it's a duty to patronize Starbucks because of its, you know, advocacy of healthcare, you know, it's certainly good that Howard Schultz is doing that. But, you know, you got to, you know, that's only one piece of what's going on there. And you have to realize that in reality, and I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but the money that you spend at Starbucks goes to building more Starbucks. And so if you're spending your money there, that's the primary result.
So, Taylor Clark, very even-handed book. You have some good and some bad. Do you come down? I mean, I know you don't personally go to Starbucks all the time because of, you know, the taste of the coffee and other reasons, but do you come down on one side or the other, that Starbucks good or bad for society, for our culture?
I try to, you know, I've given away how I kind of feel about the company here, but I say what I say, what I feel about the company in the book for the very end, for the epilogue. And, you know, all these issues are complicated. Like, you know, the one that I just mentioned of sort of, do we want to see more Starbucks stores on our streets when they're already all over the place? You know, there's going to be, you know, within a few years, there's going to be 500 Starbucks stores in Chicago, for example. And, you know, that's just a staggering number. And the answer to that question really depends on your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really what depends on what you're comfortable with, because there are a lot of people who would say that it's incredibly unethical for Starbucks to have so many stores and to be kind of infiltrating communities, but they wouldn't put them there if people didn't want to go. And so really what it comes down to is that, you know, I can be more, you know, I can be less inclined to go to Starbucks because, I don't like the coffee that much there, and, you know, I have better options here. But if I lived in a community where that wasn't the case, I might love Starbucks, you know. I'm definitely not trying to push a point of view in the book. I'm just trying to tell a good story. And the answers to all these questions about whether Starbucks is good or evil tend to be actually kind of mixed.
Right. Claire in Waukesha is with us now. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I worked for Starbucks for, a little over 2 years. And I just wanted to make a comment about tipping. I know people pay so much for the coffee, but people who work there really do depend on the tips as a part of their income. And I actually have had people take money out of the tip jar saying, oh, well, I've given Starbucks enough of my money. It's like, that's my money. That's not Starbucks money.
Yeah, that's pretty much the worst. I mean, the tipping issue is really complicated because it really depends on, you know, if you work there, you know, you want to see people stuffing dollar bills into there, even if you're getting them just a cup of drip coffee. And it's true. People do really depend on the tips there. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, there are some people who refuse to tip because, you know, it's not like they're being served at a table or anything. And there are people who tip just because they like the barista. You know, you form a relationship with these people, and, you know, you want them to have a good day. You want them to be able to eat. So,
yeah,
I mean, I personally feel like, you know, the dregs of the earth when I don't tip, you know, if I don't have change or something.
It takes a lot of nerve to actually dip into that tip jar and take money away.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Claire, thank you for the call. Fred in Palmyra. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have to agree with Joy that the Starbucks coffee isn't that great.
It's got that bitter, or kind of that burnt taste, doesn't it, Fred?
But I'll go and get a cup of Starbucks if that's around, and you know, it's better than the coffee you used to drink in the greasy spoons where they leave the coffee pot sitting on the burner, and you know, and it's really awful.
Right.
You got an outfit there in Madison called Cargo Coffee down on Park Street that's a heck of a lot better taste than coffee. And the Altera Coffee Brewers from there's one in Milwaukee that is real good.
Oh yeah, there's lots of good local premium coffee houses. We also have in Madison, and I have to admit I've never been there personally, a Caribou Coffee, and that's the number 2 chain, right, Taylor?
Yeah, it's a very distant number 2.
Yeah, it's a Minnesota company, and it's way down.
Yeah, it's about a 25th the size of Starbucks. But you know, to the point about the coffee at Starbucks, you know, some people not thinking it's that good and thinking it's burned. I mean, that's another reason why independent coffee houses really do have a chance to compete. You know, unlike somebody like Walmart, who you know they're like a vortex to business. You know, the people don't go to independent businesses once they start going to Walmart. That's not the case with Starbucks because you know it's not that they don't have the same kind of advantages. You think about it, Starbucks is usually more expensive than the independents. And, you know, the independents oftentimes have a better product, and so, you know, they can compete. And it's not that, opening a coffee house is actually a really inexpensive investment when you compare it to a lot of other ventures, and they only fail about 10% of the time.
Do they, if the experience, though, is important, do they have to have more of the independents, more than like ratty sofas and mismatched furniture and all that? Because I've seen some like that, too.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that the coffee houses, the independent coffee houses that do well are the ones that are different from Starbucks, and they give people an alternative. Because, you know, as I say in the book, you cannot beat Starbucks at being Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
You can't try to replicate what they do, and you wouldn't really want to. You know, it's like if people wanted to go to Starbucks, they'd go to Starbucks. But if they want a sort of independent feel and more charm, they can go to one of these mom and pop places.
Yeah, some mom and pop places can have some much better food. Although a lot of people like the Starbucks food, it's all made in one or two places and shipped all over, right?
Well, some of it is. Some of it is made in central bakeries in like Texas and shipped frozen, and then they contract with local bakeries to do like the more fresh stuff. Yeah, but you know, people. I mean, I went to Paris to do you know some research on the international side of coffee, and you know, the croissants in the Starbucks in Paris, they were you know it really stretches what you want to call a croissant.
Really?
I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's especially tough when you're in a city that has no shortage of good
right.
pastries.
Jeremy in Fort Atkinson, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, okay, the reason I wanted to call was because I wanted to say unequivocally, I think Starbucks is a bad thing. And the reason for this is I think Starbucks is the chief emblem in a wave in our culture of drugs, caffeine being the drug that is used to keep people servile, working harder, and in bad health, and Starbucks is sort of one of the main culprits, or it's not doing anything good. All it's doing is bad. It's sort of like Brave New World. It's like the Soma, you know.
All
but
right.
then they come in like you know, they infiltrate in your community, and you might want to stop them. And if you want to stop them, that's when they come in like 1984, and they got the police to back them up, the government on it.
All right, Jeremy, they'll stomp you. No.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, that's what rubs a lot of people the wrong way about Starbucks, especially, is that they don't feel like they have a choice. You know, they feel like Starbucks will come in whether they say they want it or not. You know, Starbucks knows that wherever they put a store, once they figure out where the store should go, they know that people will go. And to a lot of people who want to dictate what their neighborhoods look like, they get the feeling that Starbucks just doesn't care what they think, and they're going to come in regardless, and we're going to take our money, and, you know, they're going to ship it back to Seattle, and that's that. And, you know, as for the caffeine thing, it's, you know, certainly surviving on caffeine is not a good way to live, you know. But the fact remains, you know, Starbucks didn't make people drink coffee. People were already drinking coffee. And, you know, they might have more caffeine now, but all the studies have shown, science-wise, that, you know, there's nothing in moderation. It's actually probably more beneficial to drink caffeine than not to.
Right. It almost seemed in some of those studies that it was like a miracle drug in some ways. But
it's one of those things where they do a trial, and, you know, it gives you a, you know, 5% less chance of getting, you know, liver cancer or you know, Parkinson's or something. So, you know, it's not like it's a miracle drug, but, you know, it's certainly not killing people. You know, you get the sense, like, if caffeine was that bad for you, you know, we would know by now because we'd all be dead.
Right. Mikey in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. My question to you is this. Post 9/11, everybody knows that Krispy Kreme donuts were the thing for comfort food, and I'm sure profits went absolutely through the roof. I was curious to know if Starbucks profits went through the roof post 9/11 as well.
That's a good question. And that's one of the things that kind of showed that Starbucks was a little bit more invincible than people might have thought, because when 9/11 happened and the country went into, like, you know, the minor recession of, you know, the dot-com bust and all that, Starbucks continued, you know, going great guns. So, you know, people who were unemployed would come in to, you know, to surf the internet or to get out of the house, and, you know, Starbucks never was there a moment when it started to lag in sales. So that's, you know, it's interesting because you would think that something that is such a discretionary purchase, like a $4 latte, would be one of the first things to go when people were looking to save money, but, you know, it turned out that was one of the last things people were willing to give up.
You know, another personal note, my husband's last name is Starbuck. And I could tell that Starbucks was rising in popularity in that now, and you know, starting many years ago, people started asking him if he had anything to do with the coffee house. And he does not.
I mean, yeah, he should be so lucky.
Yeah, that's what he would say. Yeah, that's what he'd say, is that nope. But the name itself, the name came from Moby Dick, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, what happened was, you know, Starbucks was founded, you know, over 30 years ago by three kind of hippies in the Seattle area, and they were all literary, artsy guys, and they were starting Starbucks as kind of a venture that was more aesthetic than financial. You know, they weren't looking to make a huge profit, and when they were looking for a name, they rejected all these things. They wanted to call it Steamer, and they wanted to use their names, but it just sounded bad, and they were all fans of Moby Dick, and so
we're almost out of time.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, they settled on Starbucks on the suggestion of someone else.
Yeah. Well, read more about it in the book Starbucked. Thanks, Taylor Clark, for being with us.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me.
Taylor Clark, author of Starbucked. Thanks to Karen Prager and to Brittany DeAnda for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.